You know, I turned 66 last week, and somebody told me, I don't know if there's any truth to this at all, but this idea that every 8 years of your life, there's a karmic switch in your life, something karmically that changes the course of your life for that next 8 years takes place, and that every 11 years you have a spiritual change, a shift of some dynamic proportion. I have no idea if it's true, but in my own life I look back on those years and there is a certain kind of symmetry to those numbers. But the thing I've noticed about hitting 66 is like a car crossing the 50,000 mile barrier. It's been happening for a while, but there comes a point where it starts to break down. And it doesn't function as well as it did before. Suddenly the car is in the shop a lot more often than it used to be when it was under 50,000 miles. And they're replacing a lot of gaskets and they're doing a lot of repairs and they're costing you more money than you want to spend and you're beginning to wonder, is it worth it? But whereas you can get a new car, you don't get a new body all that readily. So one has to try to do a number of things. Part of that is repairing what isn't working, if you can. Hopefully you can. Sometimes parts are available, sometimes they're not. And maintaining what you have. And I, like most people, spent the early part of my life very sort of uninterested in the fact that I had a body. I was much more intrigued by the fact that I had a mind, which was more of a functioning entity for me. I had a good mind, some intelligence, some creativity, and I was never very well coordinated, balanced. So I was never an athlete. I never was able to use my body well. So I figured my body's primary purpose was to hold my head up. And my head was very heavy, as are all our heads. I don't know if you know how heavy your heads are, but somebody literally gave me a piece of plaster, a plaster head to hold the other day, and it was 20 pounds. Try holding 20 pounds and realize what's resting on your neck. It's a very weighty thing. And if you have bad posture, as people of my ilk do, there's a tendency to lean forward when you're writing, lean forward when you're thinking. I even see pictures of me from the 1960s walking, and my head is about a foot ahead of my body. It's always been in leading form. It never is in alignment. It's always somehow out of kilter. And gradually, if you do that, you will notice, as I am at the age of 66, that the whole body has been pulled by that force out of alignment. And, you know, for many years in the 60s, when I first had my first awareness that the body might not be a permanent entity was the slipping of a disc in my lower back. And I had a wonderful chiropractor named Louis Savas who was able in those days to crack everything and put it all back together again in some remarkable way. And I really was a beneficiary of his artistry. But I really understood that we are impermanent creatures. And so in order to try to better my possibilities of living a semi-healthy life, I started exercising early on, and I started primarily by swimming, which is a great exercise, and I love to swim. And I swam 3 to 4 times a week for about 20 years, I guess, which was very good, and my back never had a problem. Everything was terrific. And then I started putting on weight, and a nutritionist says to take off that weight, swimming will not do it, you've got to walk. You got to use your own weight against you to burn up calories. So I got on a treadmill. I started walking through the neighborhood and walking the paths of this property. But then I got a treadmill so I could walk all winter. And walking was very good until the bottom of my foot went out, something called, I can never pronounce it, plantar fasciitis or something. Is that fasciitis? Thank you. And so I couldn't walk. And so for about almost a year, I couldn't do much, but I bought myself a recumbent bicycle and I started doing bicycling, a stationary bicycle, which didn't burn up so many calories, but it felt like I was doing something. Anyway, this is all a long story. to tell you that as best as you can do to try to prevent the deterioration of your body, there are things that go on that you don't have a lot to do with. And some of you know, a year ago I had an operation for a prostate, which didn't go so well. The prostate part did, but I had an embolism that nearly took me out of this world, which was a very important discovery for me, that we all live very close to the edge of departing, and that departure at that moment for me seemed very instructive. I've talked about this before. The instruction primarily was that there are forces prepared to help us leave this world, and they only come into play when you are unable to do anything else on your own, when you finally give up and say, I surrender, which of course is a key element of our entire teaching. Surrender is at the core of our teaching. Letting go and finally realizing, if you will, letting God do the work. But you can't usually let go until you've gotten to a fairly profound state of disappointment in your own capacity. And then you realize how limited your abilities are. Just to bring you up to date, the heaviness of my head has had a number of unfortunate aspects, and one of them is that I have herniated some discs in my neck, which some doctors tell me need an operation immediately because it's pressing into my spinal cord, and other people are telling me I should try to meditate it away. And I am really caught between these polarities of thinking mind, body, physical, metaphysical, you know, something to be dealt with as a physical entity, is something to be dealt with as a metaphysical entity, and where is my faith? Where do I put my faith? Is it in sitting still and meditating and having this biological thing alter? Or is it having somebody go in some intrusive way and actually, you know, perform an operation? And it's a very complicated decision to make. I think a lot of people face these problems because so often you feel you need to be able to do this in some spiritual way. And to this moment, I haven't made up my mind what I'm about to do. I've made an appointment for the operation, but I really haven't made up my mind. Because there are risks in every part of this, and those risks are all at this point somewhat life-threatening, which is kind of interesting, because it brings you up to a whole new level of awareness. The sword of Damocles, you know, over your head, is much more prominent for me at this moment than it has been at other times in my life. And Rudy talked a lot about walking around with the sword of Damocles hanging over his head. It was a really powerful inducement to consciousness. All of which brings me to trying to describe two very important things right now, I think. One of them is the place of suffering in human life and the place of pain. And I'm going to talk about that because, for one thing, in most of my classes, whenever I talk about suffering, everybody comes up to me after class and says, I really needed to hear that. Or you're speaking right to me. It's like somehow suffering connects in a way with a lot of people. If I talk about bliss and everything else, people like that, but the suffering goes, that's me. That's what I'm going through. And in truth, Buddha's core teaching was life is suffering. That's his core teaching. And there's anybody who's alive who has lived long enough, knows that ultimately it leads toward that. It's not exclusively suffering, but ultimately, after you're 66 or you pass the 50,000 mile mark, whatever it is, there is the decomposition of everything that has been up to that point composed. And you can maintain your health as best you can, a very good idea, I recommend it. You can try to keep your body strong, you can try to do all the things that keep you in a good place, but ultimately it will fail because this is an impermanent condition. Life, ultimately, biological life, has a limited duration. You might get 100 and some years out of it, you might only get fewer years out of it. But during that time, this experience of suffering will come to you. And the experience of pain. Rudy always said, pain is God's love. Hard line, really hard line to understand. I don't think many people do understand it. But I want to bring it right into this very moment. Because it's the only way I can really talk about this subject, and that is, I sat down today to teach, and I have pain in my neck and in my back, and you know, all the stuff that is not exclusively mine. I'm sure a lot of you have your own aches and pains, but they're very clearly there, and a kind of tiredness that is from having a head that leans forward now for 66 years, and I could see when I sat down, and this is very common, when I sit down here, I come into this room with Bruce's aches and pains, and I sit down in front of you, and something happens, and it is a hard thing to describe, but it's a really important thing, and that is, every pain is like a fuel cell. Every pain announces itself in some sort of order. I have nothing to do with it. I'm sitting down just like when you sit down, and suddenly a particular pain says, hello, and you feel it, and your mind goes there because that's where minds go, to pain usually. Then you try to figure out, how can I get away from this thing? But my teaching and my practice is not to go away from that pain. It's to go into the pain, or to sit with it and kind of acknowledge it, and to recognize that it is in some ways an expression of love. It's so counterintuitive, but that's what I do. So I sit there and I feel the pain, and I don't go anywhere. I don't run from it. I don't say it doesn't belong, or why did I get myself into this trouble, or why does God hate me, or whatever it is that people tend to do with pain. I just go, okay. And as I sit there, this thing happens inside that pain. It goes, it opens up. It just opens up at the core, like a fuel cell suddenly expelling an enormous amount of energy, and that energy becomes expressed in direct relationship to you. It's like each of you and I connect at a certain point in my own pain construct, and in a certain sense in what I sense to be your pain construct. There seems to be a dialogue between these two events, that there seems to be a reason mine emerges at a moment where I see you. And it changes, and it shifts, and it really does a kind of cosmic dance. And rather than be perceived as pain at that point, it's perceived as a kind of internal tutoring that's leading me from place to place in a very profound dialogue with you. And as I go into your system, and I sit with you, our pain-pleasure, if you will, or pain-pain, or pleasure-pleasure, whatever it is, does a kind of dance. And usually what I experience is something constricted in the people I'm sitting with, responding to the very thing in me that is expressing itself at that moment, and there is a symbiotic alteration of energy, so that your constriction and my constriction together, and the pain of my that's in my body or my energy field, becomes a force that works on you. And it opens something up inside both of us that is, to my experience, and I'm only assuming this now, but because I think it must also be to your experience somewhere, exquisitely beautiful, beyond beautiful. It is completely untying a part of you that has separated itself from consciousness or from God or from love, something that has walled you off, or a holding pattern. A lot of times that's what I feel. I go to sit with you and suddenly I feel this thing that's kind of going, not now, not today, no. This, let's just call it no. And something in me is going, yes. But if I say yes directly to your no, what happens is your no gets worse, it gets stronger. So instead of that, I feel this pain, and something in my pain and something in your no relate to each other, and they go, and they dissipate. It's a dance. It's a practice. I don't get it completely. I don't understand all of what it is that's going on, but I do know in my own inner system something is getting freed continually during the course of this class. And what's also very interesting, don't ask me how this works, as I work with somebody and something opens inside them, there is a rippling effect that goes to everybody in the class, and everyone in the class is part of this dynamic, and something opens in everybody else. You can just feel it. It's like a chain reaction. It just happens. And whoever has gathered in that space, in that moment, is a participant in the chain reaction. It even goes beyond the walls of this room, but I don't know how that works. I don't even know how this works. But I do know that it does work. And I do know that in the embrace of pain, or the acknowledgement of it, you don't have to love the pain. You just have to know that it is there as a form of love. In allowing it to be and not fighting it and not cursing it and just saying, okay, something transformative occurs. And that transformation is a gradual liberation of you from the dynamic of obstruction and resistance that basically is the structure of most people's lives. What you see when you deal with people is all of their patterns of no, and how it has become to, how it's begun to affect their body, their mind, the way they carry themselves, the way they act in the world, their emotional life, their sexual life, their spiritual life. You see this extraordinary kind of resistance to and holding away from others, closing down, shutting down, protection. And the spiritual expression is the opposite of that. It's the opening of all of these things. And what happens, of course, in someone who's working spiritually and continually and purposefully, this opening pretty much stays open. If someone is casual in their relationship to their practice, this opening that occurs in the class will be closed the next time they come to class, which I see a lot. I see a lot of people sitting down and opening the same lock over and over and over and over. It's a kind of absurdity on some level, which I could be judgmental about, but that is worthless. Why should I be judgmental about it? My sense of it is that if somebody is going to open the same lock for 30 years, at some point that lock's going to break. It's just going to break, and they won't have it anymore. So I don't care if it takes 30 years. Better to break it over a course of 30 years than to not address it at all. But if someone is working really deeply, one lock after another unlocks, one holding pattern after another releases, and you start to feel a sense of liberation and lightness. Does that mean you will not feel pain? No. Because if it did, I would come into this classroom and feel like I was some sort of light angelic presence, just sending off all of this ease and light, which in a way is what I feel, but it's coming from pain. So the pain is an absolutely crucial part of the light, of the angelic. You can't have one without the other. The real difference is you don't sit in judgment of it. You don't sit in dread of it. You just go, okay, that's what it is. Now, I cannot tell you that during the day when this thing starts to drive me crazy in the middle of a meeting or something else, that I'm sitting in such a perfect space with it. I wish I could, because I think there are people who do. But in the middle of the day, I'm just sort of like, grab an aspirin or something. You know, try to do something to just mollify it for the time being. And then when I come to my sitting, my meditation, that's the work. That's when I really do the work. I think people who are more established than I am, or better meditators than I am, or whatever, maybe figure it out all during the day, and they're always on top of this human body construction thing that we're dealing with. But you do your best. You do your best, and you forgive yourself, and you forgive everyone else their failing. Because this is hard work. It's hard work. We are completely unprepared for it in our life. Nobody instructs us. Schools do not teach classes on what we're talking about here. Nobody has a clue. What we're told is go to a doctor and they'll fix it. To some degree they do sometimes. Doctors have certain cures. Many of the times they cannot even begin to address what's going on inside you, which is often the case because we are a complexity beyond understanding. But all I can say is we are our own being. We have to hold our own counsel. We have to figure things out as best we can for ourselves. I know in the old days when someone told Rudy, I have a headache, and you know, and they were trying to make it into this great spiritual event, and but they were complaining about it, and they said to Rudy, what should I do? And Rudy said, you know, take an aspirin. And I really appreciated that, because everybody wants to make their physical life somehow, to idealize it on some level, to make themselves feel, oh, all of this suffering has spiritual purpose. Well, yes and no. I mean, it does, but if you can take an aspirin and get rid of it, that's terrific. If you can take a Tylenol or whatever you take, Rolaids, do it. But when you can't, then you have to look for something else. Look, see what's available. Life is about choices. It's got material choices and spiritual choices. We all have these possibilities in our lives that we can address and we can draw from and we can use as the tools for building an internal spiritual existence. Find the ones that work for you and use them as best you can, and take responsibility for your choices, and to whatever degree possible, feel inside that you are connected as deeply as you can feel to what is going on inside you. And what is going on inside you is nothing other than God's presence in your life. Pleasure or pain or indifference or bliss, it's all God's presence. Really important to know that. So, any questions? Pardon? Did I have 2 points?
Yeah, 2 points. The first one is the suffering, I think.
What was the first one?
Yeah, you said you had two basic things you wanted to...
That makes absolute sense. I'll tell you something else that happened this week. I took a memory test. I took a test for Lyme disease, which is something I've had 5 times here. And the test was a cognitive test, trying to map out where my brain works and doesn't work. And the first thing that happened was they asked me to listen to a short story and repeat the story back to them right afterward. Or they're going to ask me questions about it, actually, with as much information as I could recall. I couldn't recall anything. I was completely shocked. My brain could not recall what I had just heard. And I went, what's that about? It almost brought me to tears because I had no idea. I've had a feeling my memory was not working so well these days, but I truly, truly couldn't remember the stories. And then they gave me these pictures that had circles, squares, and triangles, and some embedded in each other, and they would show it to you, and you'd look at it, you go, I get that. They put it down for 10 seconds and said, now draw it. I couldn't remember. Did the triangle go this way or that way, or was it a circle here, a circle there? I could not remember. So, along with all of my other faculties and physical infirmities, I'm suffering mental infirmities as well. So if I had 2 points at the beginning of this, I'll listen to the tape that I just made. and next week I will tell you what point two is, because I have no idea. I never remember. And when I talk in these classes, honestly, and I write down, I try to write down the topic of the talk for the website, I cannot remember the topic of the talk, let alone what the talk embodied. Blanche always tells me after class, she says, I hope you listen to what you just said. Because it arrives. These things arrive, it expresses itself. I have much less to do with it than anybody imagines. It is its own thing. And I really do need to listen to my talks as much as anybody else does, because it's not Bruce speaking, it's something speaking to all of us together. At least it has that feel, you know. And when I write well, the best of my writing is exactly the same experience. The worst of my writing, I produce. Sure. The best of it produces itself. It's the gift. So I'm sorry, if there were 2 points, and I sort of vaguely remember that there were 2 points, but I think in some way I've covered them.
Well, whatever Bruce's or what's ever coming through Bruce's 2 points, where I did wonder whether it's right to really say that the Buddhist teaching, main teaching, core teaching, is life is suffering, or whether in fact he was making two basic points in the first two noble truths, which is A, life is suffering, B, suffering is caused by self-centered clinging. Just to say there's a way out of the suffering, it's not inevitable.
I think that's what the talk was about, but let me explain that. One is, I'm not a Buddhist scholar, and I really misappropriate Buddhist teaching when I talk. And I apologize to every Buddhist out there. I really try to take what I can think and remember of Buddhist teaching. But the way out of suffering, which is what Buddha talks about, which is striving, self-striving, and clinging, as you describe it, is essentially sitting in the midst of that and being with it. And not owning it or rejecting it, allowing it to be, and allowing it to be is the very thing which dissipates the suffering as something which is a punishment, if you will. It does not in any way get rid of it as its own thing. There is definitely something in there that is uncomfortable, but it allows you a completely different relationship with that suffering, which is that you don't fight it. You don't see it as, you don't cling to the pain of it, and you don't cling to the desire to release it. It's by just allowing it to be what it is that something takes place. There's an alignment that takes place where it's no longer an issue. It's no longer a battle. And most suffering is a battle. And as soon as the battle is over, there's still that source of that thing. It's really yin-yang. I mean, you don't ever get to just yin. It just doesn't happen. Yin-yang is the essence of at least materialized existence. One does not exist without the other. And when you allow both to be, then you find this transcendent truth. When you are only wanting one over the other, only wanting the bliss of transcendence, you're in an illusory state. You cannot have the bliss of transcendence without having the thing itself that you're transcending as an anchor in that, that's part of the whole process. And if you try to have one without the other, you're not going to get it. And I think a lot of people who look for the release of suffering thinking that, oh, there's not going to be any suffering. Not true. There will be suffering, but it won't matter. Or you'll have a different perspective on it that will allow it to be without it causing you grief. And then there will come a point, as you know, I talked to you about this with Nisargadatta, one of the great teachers, who at the end of his life of smoking his whole life, had throat cancer that was unbearably painful. And he was not a happy camper. You know, this great enlightened guy was in enormous pain, wondering, why did I ever choose to be incarnated? And that was so important to me. His great teaching to me was, we cannot escape this stuff. And there comes a point where you really arrive at such extremity, I think, that you have to, at that moment, just say, I don't know what to do. All of my teaching, all of my transcendence, all of my gift of spiritual life is meaningless in the face of something that is so extreme. And when that happens, and you really give up, I think you really discover the ultimate transcendence. That's my guess. But what do I know? Is that...
Covered point two,
or, you know, extricated myself from the contempt of the Buddhist community. You know, I hate that I don't, I really don't have a highly tutored knowledge base, but it's just enough to get myself in trouble. So, you know, forgive me.
Not only you in trouble, all of us.
Well, maybe.
There's a few comments. First of all, you're a lucky man. You started experiencing a problem only at age 66. You should understand this better.
Thank you.
Secondly, we're in the point how we can differentiate the functional from organic problem. So which problem we can fix by mediation, or which problem we have to go to the doctor and say, I surrender to you. And third, your dilemma that you're suffering, do the surgery, don't do the surgery. During your talk, you answer your question by word by your teacher, Rudy, take aspirin. And it means...
have the operation.
Go to the neurosurgery.
You know, I mean, again, I hate to make this so public on some level, but every surgeon I went to who looked at the pictures of my, you know, on my chart, they all went... they had a gasp, like, yikes. And they all said, you've got to do this. So, I mean, I think in the end... that's probably my decision. I mean, it's become very mental on some level, but the spiritual, the deeper feeling, certainly during the class, was just trust. Whatever you do, trust it. And but it does feel to me like taking care of this is probably a good idea. So we'll leave it at that. Thank you.
It's just a comment. It seems that. Through meditation, it's not how we fix it, but how we get to the right answer for us, how we find our intuition deep in our gut and find the answer that's right for us.
You know, I believe that, but what's often been the case for me in certain kinds of questions is I go as deep as I can get and there is no answer. It just doesn't present itself. And my response to that over the years is, if there is an answer, follow it. If there is no answer, it's because it doesn't matter what you do. You can do one or the other. Ultimately, if you choose not to do one or the, if you choose to do anything and it's the wrong one, it will let you know. Something will come about and you will know, and then the answer will present itself. But often in this particular moment, there is no answer. And so I figure, go take the right road or the left road, you'll get to the same place. So, you know, we're all, it's not all that difficult in the end. We make it very difficult. And we all live such unconscious lives usually that these things become bigger issues than perhaps they should. But if that's your, if it's an issue for you and you've got to face this stuff, you have to face it. And the only thing I know is that if you keep putting off facing something, the revelation of what you've put off becomes more painful. The longer you wait, the more problem you develop. And that's been a real big lesson for me in my life. And we all learn these lessons. The great thing about life lessons is that we all are being tutored all the time. But as my cousin Joni said so brilliantly once, she said, the biggest problem with life lessons is that we never learn them. We repeat them over and over and over and over until one day they finally impact at least one or two of them. And we know something. And then you write a book and make $1 million, you know, and then you live forever trying to sell your idea of that lesson. Anyway, thank you all very much for coming here today. Class next Sunday is in the city. And the week after that, which will be the week after the operation, I don't know that I'll be able to teach a class here. And I will send out an email if I think I can, and I'll just cancel class. We'll figure it out.
With Blanche or somebody else?
Yes. I mean, that's, were you planning to teach that weekend anyway? That's true. So what we don't know is whether I can travel from the city to up here. So we'll just have to work it out.
Mm-hmm. I just have one or two more comments about what we've been talking about. One is that I what you say sounds very right in terms of the practical world, and where if you don't come to an answer intuitively, it either kind of works and you just trust it. But that's in the hall of mirrors, in what could be considered the realer world. It seems to me that if neither of the either or really feels like the right direction, then the deeper answer, it seems to me, speaking of Buddhism, is what's the sound of one hand clapping, which is not one, not two, which doesn't necessarily affect at all your practical decision, but spiritually it can be beyond enriching to come to that point.
I think that point of the sound of one hand clapping brings you to peace with whatever decision you make. But I don't think it makes the decision.
True.
So it just allows you to know that you're at one with that. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, what one wants to get to, whatever one decision one makes. The practical world wants direct guidance. Unfortunately, there are certain decisions where it's just not possible. You can break things down to minuscule little sort of aspects and see what weights it one way or the other, but often, you know, one molecule doesn't weigh it enough to make you go one way or the other, so it's just not enough, or we can't perceive it. But I do think the sound of one hand clapping and the arrival at that place in yourself is ideal in every circumstance in your life, to live from that place, to be that. But to be that, practice of Buddhism is trying to get to that place over and over. Enlightenment is not having to try to get there anymore.
Perhaps.
Yes, is that a question?
No, I was just thinking, it's only a decision if the evidence and information are not sufficient to not have to make a decision. You know, if the evidence and information doesn't provide enough by itself, that's when a decision occurs.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I certainly know in my situation, you know, you can only get so much information in a certain amount of time to weigh it enough intelligently to make an informed decision. Informed decisions are better than uninformed decisions, but sometimes information just isn't enough to be clear. And when that's the case, you do your best, you go into that intuitive place and you try to do it from there. And if you can't, you just pick one and see what happens. I mean, my sense is if I choose not to do this operation now, 6 months from now or a year from now, I won't have a choice. That's my guess. But who knows? So it's, you know, these are human dilemmas. We all face them all the time, and ultimately the process is the same. You weigh what you have, you make an intuitive decision, or you choose not to choose, which is a decision, and then at some point the problem itself reappears in a new guise where the decision is clear or clearer. So
just one comment on the rippling through the whole class thing.
Mm-hmm.
I do think, speaking of Buddhism, that the image of Indra's net in Buddhism, where you have this three-dimensional net with jewels or diamonds at each node where the ropes connect, and the whole net is reflected in every single diamond, is a fairly good model for understanding how the rippling occurs.
Yeah, no, I mean, the holographic experience, which, you know, in the 60s, holography became a, you know, an idea which is very similar to that, in which every molecule, you know, reflects the whole from a different place, perhaps, but it reflects the whole, is also, for me, the same idea. Everything affects everything. And I'm always intrigued, really intrigued by the fact that, let's say, when I'm working with you, the release that occurs in you, if that's the way I experience it, seems to float over to Marty, who has, in her own way, somehow placed herself in approximation with you, and that thing goes to her, and I can feel when it goes to her, that's exactly what she needed. And I go, wow, Tony's release is what Marty needed, and it went to Julia, and I can feel how it plays itself out, and I just get kind of amazed by how all of this stuff is so perfect. It's perfect beyond our understanding of perfection. And, you know, you can't even imagine how do things order themselves in that way. All you do is you kind of feel this thing inside you that I just call gratitude and love. You just go, or awe and worship. You can be all of those things, but that's what you feel. It's like, how did I ever get to be part of this? Or what is my relationship to this? Or the biggest part of it is that you don't even feel you so much. It's just this collective beauty. Anyway. That's the poetic part of all of what we're doing. Okay, long talk. Thank you guys very, very much. I, you know, always appreciate you being here. And if I don't see you in the city, perhaps next weekend here. And if not that, I'll be back sometime in April.